Lincoln, Disc 19.
Persistent sniping from members of his own party in Congress made the president's burdens all the harder to bear. There was a growing lack of harmony among Republicans in Congress. On economic issues, Republican legislators divided along sectional lines, with Easterners opposing Westerners on such issues as a land-grant college system, the chartering of a Pacific Railroad, a proposed increase in the tariff, and the creation of an Internal Revenue System that would, for the first time since 1817, levy taxes on domestic producers and consumers. Lincoln was personally involved in a few of these questions. What he called his political education as a Whig made him averse to trying to lead the Congress in such matters and reluctant to veto measures with which he disagreed. But he was deeply involved in questions relating to the prosecution of the war, the future of the rebellious states, and the status of slavery, on which Republican congressmen also differed. Factional lines weren't yet clear. At one end of the spectrum were the self-styled radicals, who believed that vigorous prosecution of the war required confiscation of Southern property and the emancipation of slaves. At the other end, a less clearly defined group of moderates, who sometimes referred to themselves as conservatives, wanted the war to be conducted without destroying the property or social fabric of the South. Neither group accepted Lincoln's view that the prosecution of the war was primarily a function of the chief executive, and neither was firmly committed to supporting the president and his policies. A radical like Wade denounced Lincoln for incompetence and imbecility, but so did a moderate like Senator William Pitt Fessenden of Maine, who lamented that no man can be found who's equal to this crisis in any branch of the government, and added sarcastically, if the president had his wife's will and would use it rightly, our affairs would look much better. Republican congressmen were critical of the president, partly because their party had never before been in power, and they weren't used to the responsibility of constructive leadership. The party's spokesmen had made their reputations by denouncing Presidents Pierce and Buchanan. The habit was hard to break. Many of the congressional leaders, especially in the Senate, were insiders with long experience in Washington, and they looked on Lincoln as an outsider, responsible only to their local constituents. Republican senators and representatives had difficulty recognizing Lincoln's precarious position. As a minority president, he had to receive support from Democrats as well as Republicans, border state men as well as Northerners, Westerners as well as Easterners. Consequently, most Republican congressmen were indifferent to the president and his wishes. Now that the patronage had been distributed, they had little to expect from the chief executive. Lincoln didn't make a practice of using the civilian and military appointments at his disposal to punish his enemies. Nor did he have the time or inclination to stroke inflated congressional egos. Legislators concluded that he was a well-meaning but incompetent president, destined to serve only one term, who could be safely ignored. A few of Lincoln's Republican critics were unwilling to maintain even a facade of good relations with the White House. These Jacobins were few in number, but because of their seniority, they held some of the most important committee chairmanships. In the Senate, Wade, Chandler, and Trumbull were the most conspicuous of these anti-Lincoln radicals, and James W. Grimes of Iowa and Morton S. Wilkinson of Minnesota often joined in attacking the administration. In public, these Republican leaders generally maintained an attitude of unctuous deference to the president. In a compliment meant to kill, Wade referred to Lincoln in a Senate speech as this mild, equitable, just man, so gentle that he exhibited a toleration and mildness towards traitors. But in private conversation, Wade was ferociously hostile. When the Committee on the Conduct of the War met with Lincoln on December 31st, Wade said bluntly, "Mr. President, you are murdering your country by inches in consequence of the inactivity of the military and the want of a distinct policy in regard to slavery." At times, the Jacobins went out of their way to insult the president. Invited to attend a White House ball, Wade returned the card with the note, "Are the President and Mrs. Lincoln aware that there is a civil war? If they are not, Mr. and Mrs. Wade are, and for that reason decline to participate in feasting and dancing." In part, the Jacobins' vindictive hostility to Lincoln stemmed from disappointment. Wade never got over his failure to receive the Republican nomination in 1860. Trumbull felt slighted in the distribution of patronage and angrily vowed never again to enter the White House while Lincoln was president. But personality conflicts were more important. Lincoln's flexibility and pragmatism fundamentally offended doctrinaires immovably committed to a fixed position. His gaily announced motto was, "My policy is to have no policy." Even Chase, a member of his own cabinet, called this an idiotic notion, while to Wade and Grimes it showed that the president had no principles. Humorless and literal-minded, Lincoln's Republican critics found his pragmatism either cowardly or frivolous, and they were unable to see that behind his adaptability as to means lay a firm commitment to ends, such as the preservation of the Union and the spread of liberty. Hating no man himself, Lincoln found the ferocity of these Jacobins puzzling. It wasn't what he expected from men whose records as leaders of the anti-slavery cause he'd studied and admired. He told John Hay that the persistent opposition of Senator Grimes was one of his greatest disappointments as president. "Before I came here," Lincoln said, "I certainly expected to rely upon Grimes more than any other one man in the Senate. I like him very much. He's a great, strong fellow. He's a valuable friend, a dangerous enemy. But he got wrong against me. I don't clearly know how, and has always been cool and almost hostile to me." He failed to realize that there was a temperamental incompatibility between himself and these anti-Lincoln radicals. The fault wasn't all theirs. If the Jacobins were overbearing, Lincoln was often evasive and elusive. He made few attempts to reveal his motives or explain his plans to these serious, self-important men accustomed to deference. Lincoln wasn't a modest man, and, as John Hay astutely observed, he quite inadvertently exhibited toward these critics an intellectual arrogance and unconscious assumption of superiority that mortally offended them. Toward the end of January 1862, military affairs took a turn for the better. When Lincoln finally got rid of Cameron, he moved quickly to replace him with Edwin M. Stanton. The appointment was a surprising one. In view of Lincoln's well-known unwillingness to cherish grudges, it wasn't important that Stanton was the lawyer who'd snubbed him in the McCormick Reaper case. but Stanton's lifelong record as a Democrat might have counted against him. He'd been Attorney General in the last days of the Buchanan regime, and had done something to give backbone to that feeble regime and to make possible a peaceful transfer of power to the Lincoln administration. Since the outbreak of the war, Stanton, in his private correspondence, had unsparingly criticized the imbecility of this administration. But he'd maintained a discreet silence in public and served as a confidential legal advisor to Cameron. Always opposed to slavery, Stanton was secretly the author of the passage in Cameron's report that called for freeing and arming the slaves. He was thus responsible for the firing of the man whom he succeeded. That double role wasn't surprising to anyone who knew Stanton well. Gideon Welles concluded that the new Secretary of War was arrogant and domineering toward those in subordinate positions, but a sycophant and intriguer in his conduct and language with those whom he fears. He managed to ingratiate himself with everybody whose support he needed. McClellan endorsed him, as did the Committee on the Conduct of the War. Fierce Unionists like Joseph Holt praised him as the soul of honor, of courage, and of loyalty. And so did Fernando Wood, the New York mayor who flirted with secession. Cameron recommended Stanton as his replacement. Miraculously, so did both Seward and Chase, permanent antagonists in the cabinet. Stanton was neither amiable nor altogether stable, but Lincoln found him indispensable. A short, stocky figure, 57 years old, the new Secretary of War was highly intelligent and fiercely honest. In the War Department, he worked standing behind a long, high desk, which he moved into a room open to the public, where he excoriated shoddy contractors and blasted military officers angling for promotion. His extraordinary energy reminded Lincoln of an old Methodist preacher whose parishioners wanted to put bricks in his pockets to hold him down. "We may be obliged to serve Stanton the same way," Lincoln told Congressman Dawes, "but I guess we'll just let him jump a while first." The president and his new war secretary developed an excellent working relationship, which eventually became a warm friendship. The president knew that Stanton was imperious and hot-tempered, and that he sometimes made decisions that appeared arbitrary, but he tried not to interfere. "Of course," he wrote to a friend who complained of Stanton's brusqueness, "I can overrule his decision if I will, but I can't well administer the War Department independent of the Secretary of War." There developed a sort of tacit division of labor between the two men. Lincoln himself explained the system. "I want to oblige everybody when I can, and Stanton and I have an understanding that if I send an order to him, which can't be consistently granted, he's to refuse it. This he sometimes does." Occasionally, the president pretended that the Secretary of War exerted a veto over his actions. Referring to the censorship of newspapers, a job he entrusted to Stanton, Lincoln once explained why he refused to make a public speech. "The Secretary of War, you know, holds a pretty tight rein on the press, so that they shan't tell more than they ought to, and I'm afraid that if I blab too much, he might draw a tight rein on me." But that, of course, was a joke. When Stanton turned down a request Lincoln thought important, the president overruled him with, "Let it be done." With Stanton in control at the War Department, the president could turn his attention back to the armies. His conferences with McClellan had disappointed him. and the general, whose health was now fully restored, was still reluctant to divulge his plans for an advance. On January 27th, Lincoln forced the issue by publishing the President's General War Order No. 1. It ordered all the land and naval forces of the United States to undertake a general advance on February 22nd, and threatened to hold all commanders to strict accountability for carrying out the order. The order, which vented Lincoln's deep sense of frustration with the military, reflected his recent hasty reading of books on strategy. Since McClellan seemed to have no plan for operations against the Confederates, the president announced his own. As he told Browning, it was to threaten all their positions at the same time with superior force, and if they weakened one to strengthen another, seize and hold the one weakened. Both Lincoln's strategy and his order ignored such variables as the weather, readiness, roads, communications, and logistics, not to mention the location and strength of the Confederate armies. But he didn't intend to announce a specific plan of battle. He wanted to give a jolt to the military, a warning that they must act. In that sense, it worked. February 22nd passed without a general advance. But before that date, Union armies in the West began to win victories. On January 19th, a few days before Lincoln's order, Union troops under General George H. Thomas routed Confederate forces in the Battle of Mill Springs and broke the Confederate line in eastern Kentucky. More significant was a campaign that General Ulysses S. Grant launched to open the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers. On February 6th, Grant's forces, aided by Navy gunboats under Flag Officer Andrew Foote, captured Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, and 11 days later, they forced Fort Donelson to surrender. The Confederates had to abandon Kentucky and most of Tennessee, and on February 25th, Buell's army occupied Nashville. This was a heady time for an administration that, up to now, had had few successes. When Lincoln signed the papers promoting Grant to the rank of Major General, he could hardly contain his satisfaction. He didn't feel competent to speak about the fighting qualities of Eastern men, he observed, but the recent gallant behavior of Illinois troops showed that if the Southerners think that man for man they're better than our Western men generally, they'll discover themselves in a grievous mistake. In the national capital, there was a general sense of euphoria, a belief that with one big push by the Army of the Potomac, the Confederacy could be defeated. Even Lincoln shared in this optimism. When Joshua Speed learned that the president, in order to make room for Cameron, was allowing Cassius M. Clay to resign as minister to Russia and take up a commission as major general, he rushed to the White House to protest the return of this loose cannon to Kentucky. The president assured his old friend that there was nothing to worry about because the war would be over before Clay could get back to the United States. A large party the Lincolns gave on February 5th, the very evening, as it happened, before Grant captured Fort Henry, was a sign of the changing times. Ignoring the advice of the protocol officers at the State Department that the president's entertainment should be confined to soirees open to the public at large and to small private dinners, Mary Lincoln decided to show off the newly refurbished White House to 500 invited guests, who were required to present tickets of invitation at the door. Inevitably, there was much grumbling among those who were not invited. Carriages began arriving about 9 in the evening, with besorted, over-decorated diplomats, generals in bright dress uniforms, members of the cabinet, Supreme Court justices, and selected senators and representatives. Ushered in by a staff dressed in new mulberry-colored uniforms to match the new Solferino china, guests were greeted in the East Room by the President, who was wearing a new black swallowtail coat, and the First Lady, whose white silk dress, decorated with hundreds of small black flowers, exposed a remarkably low décolletage. In the background, the United States Marine Band played, its repertoire including a sprightly new piece, the Merry Lincoln Polka. At midnight, the doors to the dining room were opened to reveal a magnificent buffet concocted by Maillard's of New York, the most expensive caterer in the country. It displayed sugary models of the Ship of State, Fort Sumter, and Fort Pickens, flanked by mounds of turkey, duck, ham, terrapin, and pheasant. Dinner was served until 3, and many guests stayed till daybreak. Altogether, the Washington Star concluded, the party was the most superb affair of its kind ever seen here. The Lincoln celebrations were short-lived. Shortly before the party, their son Willie had fallen ill with bilious fever, probably typhoid fever caused by pollution in the White House water system. Deeply anxious, his parents considered canceling the grand reception, but the family doctor assured them that the boy was in no immediate danger. Even so, both the president and his wife quietly slipped upstairs during the party to be at their son's bedside. During the next 2 weeks, Tad came down with the same illness, while Willie grew worse and worse. Sitting up with his sick children night after night, Lincoln was able to transact little business, and he seemed to stumble through his duties. There were fluctuations in Willie's illness, but during the 2 weeks after the grand party, he grew weaker and weaker, and Lincoln began to despair of his recovery. On February 20th, the end came. Stepping into his office, Lincoln said in a voice choked with emotion, "Well, Nicolay, my boy is gone. He's actually gone." Then he burst into tears and left to give what comfort he could to Tad. Both parents were devastated by grief. When Lincoln looked on the face of his dead son, he could only say brokenly, "He was too good for this earth, but then we loved him so." It seemed appropriate that Willie's funeral, which was held in the White House, was accompanied by one of the heaviest wind and rain storms ever to visit Washington. Long after the burial, the president repeatedly shut himself in a room so that he could weep alone. At nights, he had happy dreams of being with Willie, only to wake to the sad recognition of death. On a trip to Fort Monroe, long after Willie was buried, Lincoln read passages from Macbeth and King Lear aloud to an aide, and then from King John, he recited Constance's lament for her son. "And, Father Cardinal, I have heard you say that we shall see and know our friends in heaven. If that be true, I shall see my boy again." His voice trembled, and he wept. The president gained some respite from his suffering by caring for Tad, who was still very ill and was heartbroken over the loss of his brother. Often Lincoln lay on the bed beside his sick son to soothe him and give him comfort. During this time, he increasingly turned to religion for solace. As Mary Lincoln said years later, "He first thought about this subject when Willie died, never before." That statement perhaps told more about the lack of intimacy in the Lincoln marriage than it did about the president's state of mind. Since his election, he had come increasingly to speak and think in religious terms. Before 1860, he rarely invoked the deity in his letters or speeches, but after he began to feel the burdens of the presidency, he frequently asked for God's aid. In his farewell address in Springfield, for instance, he reminded his fellow townsmen, "Without the assistance of the divine being, I can't succeed." Again and again on his way to Washington, he praised the providence of God who has never deserted us, and voiced confidence that the Almighty, the Maker of the universe, would save the nation. In his inaugural address, he expressed the hope that impending war could be avoided by intelligence, patriotism, Christianity, and a firm reliance on Him who has never yet forsaken this favored land. Though deeply felt, these were abstract invocations of a higher power to save a society. He now needed more personal reassurance to save himself. During the weeks after Willie's death, Lincoln had several long talks with the Reverend Phineas D. Gurley, pastor of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in Washington, where the Lincolns rented a pew. Gently, the clergyman comforted him with the assurance that Willie was not dead, but still lived in heaven. Lincoln may not have believed him, but he wished to believe him. He didn't experience a religious conversion, though when he looked back on the events of this tragic spring, he recognized that he underwent what he called a process of crystallization in his religious beliefs. Even so, he didn't become a member of any Christian denomination, nor did he abandon his fundamental fatalism. He continued to quote Hamlet, "There's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will." Mary Lincoln's grief over Willie's death was even more devastating than her husband's. Having earlier lost Eddie in Springfield, she couldn't deal with this second death. And for 3 weeks she took to her bed, so desolated that she couldn't attend the funeral or look after Tad, who was slowly beginning to recover. For many months, the mere mention of Willie's name sent her into paroxysms of weeping, and Lincoln had to employ a nurse to look after her. Never again did Mary Lincoln enter the bedroom where Willie died, nor the downstairs green room where his body had been embalmed. When she was finally able to emerge from her room, she went into such profound mourning dress that she was almost invisible under the layers of black veils and crepes. For nearly a year, all social activities at the White House were suspended. Mary Lincoln's mourning was so absolute that she forbade the weekly concerts the Marine Band usually played on the grounds. "When we're in sorrow," she announced, "quiet is very necessary to us." A few people took mean satisfaction in the Lincoln's tragedy. "I suppose Mrs. Lincoln will be providentially deterred from giving any more parties, which scandalized so many good persons who didn't get invitations," a Washington merchant wrote. David Davis, who disliked Mary Lincoln as much as he admired her husband, speculated, "It may be that this affliction may save his wife from further gossip and may change her notions of life." At about the time of Willie's death, Lincoln's optimism about military affairs also began to vanish. There were still some successes to celebrate. In the West, the Union victory at Pea Ridge, Arkansas, March 6th through 8th, ended the threat of a Confederate invasion of Missouri. In the east, Ambrose E. Burnside, after capturing Roanoke Island, moved inland to New Bern, North Carolina, which could serve as a base for future operations. But elsewhere, there was no progress. After the victories at Forts Henry and Donelson, the armies in the Mississippi Valley seemed unable to advance. Receiving no dispatches from Grant for 2 weeks, Halleck assumed that his subordinate was demoralized by victory and removed him from command. Reports spread that Grant had gone back to his old habits, and in Washington he was now considered little better than a common gambler and drunkard. Eventually, Halleck learned that Grant had been in Nashville conferring with Buell about a joint advance, and that a telegraph operator failed to transmit his dispatches. The controversy was important only in that it entailed further delay before the army pushed south. Even less encouraging were the activities of the Army of the Potomac. The president's General War Order No. 1 finally forced McClellan to discuss his broad strategy with his commander-in-chief. The general was now convinced that a frontal assault on the Confederate army at Manassas, whose size he consistently overrated, could only lead to another disaster like Bull Run. The proper object of the Union army, he argued, was the capture of Richmond, and he developed an elaborate strategy for attacking the Confederate capital from the east, where the Navy could protect his line of supplies. In Lincoln's view, the campaign ought to be directed not against the southern capital, but at the Confederate army, and he favored a direct advance on Manassas. That essential difference shaped the relationship between Lincoln and McClellan. Over the next few months, the general did everything in his power to promote acceptance of his strategy, while the president dragged his feet. Self-absorbed and insensitive, McClellan seemed totally unaware that in a democratic society, military commanders are subordinate to civilian authorities, and he felt no need to keep the president informed, much less to seek his advice. For his part, Lincoln, reluctant directly to interfere with military matters when he had no expertise, failed to make McClellan understand that when he made a suggestion, he expected the general to follow it. This mutual distrust destroyed any chance for a successful campaign. 4 days after his General War Order No. 1, Lincoln, whose patience was growing thin, issued another order specifically directing the Army of the Potomac to advance and seize Manassas on or before February 22nd. Upon receiving it, McClellan wrote a 22-page letter to Stanton detailing his objections to a proposed frontal attack on the Confederates at Manassas, and spelling out, for the first time, his plan to attack Richmond from the east. Unimpressed, Lincoln posed a series of questions to the general. Would McClellan's plan take longer and be more costly than an advance against Manassas? Would it more certainly be successful? Would it offer a sure means of retreat in case of disaster? McClellan respectfully repeated his arguments against an attack on Manassas. Urging his own plan, he pledged, "I will stake my life, my reputation, on the result. More than that, I will stake upon it the success of our cause." Lincoln wasn't convinced, but he acquiesced. During the next month, as McClellan prepared his expedition, Lincoln watched his movements skeptically. several minor developments increased his doubts. For some time, Confederate batteries on the Virginia shore had closed the lower Potomac to navigation, and their presence was both an embarrassment and a nuisance. The Army of the Potomac claimed it was unable to remove them. Then, an enterprising young Union officer carried out an independent raid and discovered that there were hardly any fortifications on the Virginia side of the river. Even more embarrassing was McClellan's failure to force the Confederates out of Harper's Ferry, where they controlled the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, a vital link between the national capital and the West. Planning to throw a force across the Potomac on a temporary bridge, McClellan had pontoon boats built and sent up the river. They proved to be 6 inches too wide for the locks on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, and the whole project had to be abandoned. When General Randolph B. Marcy, McClellan's chief of staff and father-in-law, told Lincoln the news, he exploded. "Why in tarnation couldn't the general have known whether a boat would go through that lock before he spent $1 million getting 'em there? I'm no engineer, but it seems to me that if I wished to know whether a boat would go through a lock, common sense would teach me to go and measure it. I'm almost despairing at these results. The general impression is daily gaining ground that the general doesn't intend to do anything." Lincoln's irritability on this occasion was undoubtedly related to the excitement he and everybody else in the cabinet felt about a conflict about to take place in Hampton Roads, near Norfolk and Fort Monroe. The former USS Merrimack, now heavily armored and rechristened the CSS Virginia, steamed out of Norfolk Harbor and, virtually immune to shot and shell from the wooden ships of the Union Navy, rammed and sank the Cumberland, burned the Congress, and damaged the Minnesota and other vessels. If unchecked, the Confederate ironclad could break the blockade. There was panic in Washington. Stanton, always excitable, broke out in recriminations against Gideon Welles and the Navy and predicted that the Merrimack would soon send a cannon shot into the cabinet room. Lincoln, too, was clearly troubled, but he tried to conceal his agitation by eagerly reading the dispatches and interrogating the Navy officers who brought news of the engagement. That evening, the Monitor, a Union ironclad of such unusual design that it looked like a cheese box on a raft, appeared at Hampton Roads, ready to give battle the next day. In the engagement, on March 9th, the Merrimack was badly damaged and forced back to Norfolk. During this period of great excitement, Lincoln had a confrontation with McClellan. After complaining about the Harper's Ferry fiasco, he expressed fears that if McClellan moved his army down the Potomac to attack Richmond from the east, he'd leave Washington exposed. It had been represented to him, he said, that McClellan's move was conceived with the traitorous intent of giving over to the enemy the capital and the government, thus left defenseless. The president didn't identify his source, but he'd been talking with the fiercely anti-McClellan members of the Committee on the Conduct of the War. Furious, McClellan sprang up and told Lincoln he would permit no man to call him a traitor. Much agitated, Lincoln backed down from his accusation and, according to McClellan, said that he merely repeated what others had said, and that he didn't believe a word of it. At the end of the conversation, McClellan agreed to consult the division commanders of the Army of the Potomac on his plan. Eight of them, All younger generals who owed their promotion to McClellan favored it, but the four senior men opposed. They then trooped over to the White House, where the President and the Secretary of War questioned them closely. Both Lincoln and Stanton were clearly troubled about the safety of the national capital. But in the end, the President accepted the decision of the majority and authorized McClellan to go ahead. "We can do nothing else than accept their plan and discard all others," he told Stanton afterward. "We can't reject it and adopt another without assuming all the responsibility in the case of the failure of the one we adopt." The President, still unconvinced, made his dissatisfaction plain by ordering the reorganization of the 12 divisions of the Army of the Potomac into four corps. This action, which for some time the Committee on the Conduct of the War had been urging, was a sensible one. The Army of the Potomac was now so vast that no one commander could give sufficient attention to each of the 12 separate divisions. McClellan himself had favored such a reorganization, though he wanted to wait until after a battle and appoint as corps commanders generals who'd distinguished themselves in the field. Lincoln overruled him and named as corps leaders Generals E.V. Sumner, Irvin McDowell, Samuel P. Heintzelman, and Erasmus D. Keyes, the first three of whom had opposed McClellan's plan of campaign. Further evidence of the President's doubts about his commanding general's strategy appeared in a general war order forbidding the Army of the Potomac to change its base of operations until McClellan and the four corps commanders declared Washington entirely secure. 3 days later, the President clipped McClellan's wings even closer in a broad reorganization of the Army command. After Stanton made a full report to the Cabinet blaming McClellan for the great ignorance, negligence, and lack of order and subordination and reckless extravagance evident in the management of the Army of the Potomac, Lincoln and his advisers agreed it was too much to expect any man to be both general-in-chief of all the armies and commander of the huge Army of the Potomac when it was about to take to the field. The President relieved McClellan from his duties as general-in-chief. Henceforth, he was simply to be commander of the Department of the Potomac. Lincoln's order consolidated the several armies in the Mississippi Valley under the command of General Halleck, who claimed most of the credit for Forts Henry and Donelson. In order to pacify the abolitionists and the disgruntled German element in Missouri, Fremont was given command of the new Mountain Department, where it was assumed he would try to liberate the Unionists of eastern Tennessee. Perhaps the most significant change was that all three department commanders were to report severally and directly to the Secretary of War, who now took full charge of bringing order and efficiency to Army administration. Most people welcomed the reorganization. McClellan himself, though disgruntled that he had to learn of the reshuffling of commanders from the newspapers, accepted his demotion in good spirits and wrote Lincoln, "I shall work just as cheerfully as ever before, and no consideration of self will in any manner interfere with the discharge of my public duties." Now, at last, the way was cleared for McClellan to begin his campaign. But one final episode further weakened the President's confidence in his commander. Hearing that the Confederates were pulling back from Manassas, the general led the entire Army of the Potomac, 112,000 strong, to see what was happening. The Confederates were indeed gone, and it was clear that they had numbered less than 50,000, about half of what McClellan had estimated. The southern fortifications that had looked so formidable turned out to be mostly logs painted to resemble cannon. The whole country gave a giant horse laugh. The Confederate withdrawal from the Manassas area forced McClellan to change his plan for transporting the Army of the Potomac down the Potomac and up the Rappahannock River to Urbana, where it could make a quick dash of about 50 miles on Richmond. In their new position, the Southern forces would be between him and the Confederate capital. Quickly revising his strategy, the general decided to go farther south to the peninsula between the York and James Rivers, where Fort Monroe, guarding the entrance to the Chesapeake Bay, was still in Union hands. By April 1st, part of the Army of the Potomac was on the peninsula. Lincoln continued to watch with anxiety and doubt. Months later, he told Browning that he'd always thought McClellan's strategy was a mistake, and that his opinion always had been that the great fight should have been at Manassas. Republicans who wanted Lincoln to remove McClellan also criticized the president for not attacking slavery, the cause of the war. In Congress, these condemnations were usually indirect, as when Thaddeus Stevens, the powerful Pennsylvania Republican, without mentioning Lincoln by name, lamented that in this war there had been no declaration of the great objects of government, no glorious sound of universal liberty. But in private letters, critics bluntly referred to the president's imbecility and to his folly in attempting to preserve slavery while engaged in a war against the slave power of the South. "A more ridiculous farce was never played," wrote one of Trumbull's correspondents. Francis W. Byrd, one of the original organizers of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, felt that Lincoln had gone to the rescue of slavery, which had almost committed suicide. "The key of the slave's chain is now kept in the White House," he scolded. Some of Lincoln's close political friends were equally direct. "Our nation is on the brink of ruin," Joseph Medill lamented. "Mr. Lincoln, for God's sake and your country's sake, rise to the realization that this is a slaveholder's rebellion." An Illinois man, enraged by Lincoln's course, predicted that if a speedy change didn't soon occur, some Brutus would arise and love his country more than he did the president. Lincoln's views on slavery were not, in fact, so far from those of his critics. He made no attempt to disguise his anti-slavery feeling. As he told a group of border state representatives, he thought it was wrong and should continue to think so. He agreed that slavery was somehow the cause of the war, and he didn't think it could long survive the present conflict. In areas where he felt he was constitutionally able to act, he took small but significant steps to dissociate himself from the pro-slavery stance of his predecessors. He willingly signed a law prohibiting slavery in all the national territories, even though the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott decision had declared such exclusion unconstitutional. He welcomed a new treaty with Great Britain for the more effective suppression of the Atlantic slave trade. At the urging of Charles Sumner, he refused to commute the death penalty for Nathaniel Gordon, the first American slave trader convicted and hanged for participating in the nefarious traffic. But he was reluctant to adopt more sweeping policies. He was ready to use all indispensable means to preserve the Union, but he warned against hastily adopting radical and extreme measures which may reach the loyal as the disloyal. In considering the policy to be adopted for suppressing the insurrection, he told Congress in December 1861, "I've been anxious and careful that the inevitable conflict for this purpose shall not degenerate into a violent and remorseless revolutionary struggle." Remembering his inaugural vow not to interfere with slavery in the states where it already existed, and adhering to his theory that the seceded states were still part of the Union, he was not yet ready to strike at slavery in the Confederacy, especially since nothing he could do or say would have any practical effect there. The constant barrage of criticism to which Lincoln was subjected had the wholesome result of forcing him to think through more systematically his position on slavery and emancipation. Up to this time, he hadn't been called on to do much more than express his dislike for the peculiar institution, his hope that in time it would die out, and his vague wish that Negroes should be colonized elsewhere. As Stephen A. Douglas repeatedly pointed out in their 1858 debates, he never explained how he expected to bring slavery into a course of ultimate extinction. Now he was obliged to come up with a positive policy. There was all the more urgency for him to act because Congress was pushing ahead with consideration of Trumbull's second confiscation bill, which would, in effect, emancipate the slaves of all rebels. Doubting both the constitutionality and the wisdom of proclaiming general emancipation, Lincoln felt obliged to deal with some immediate problems arising from slavery. One of these was what to do with the thousands of slaves who fled from their masters to seek freedom behind the lines of the Union armies. Since the Fugitive Slave Act was still in force, some Union commanders in the West, like Halleck, allowed slave masters to search their army camps and reclaim these fugitives. Unwilling to return the runaways, General Benjamin F. Butler, a Massachusetts anti-slavery man, called them contraband of war, on the ground that they were, or could be, used by their masters to help build Confederate fortifications, and refused to send them back to slavery. His decision was immensely popular in the North, and for the rest of the war, slaves were often referred to as contrabands. Lincoln made no official comment on Butler's action, or on the decision of other commanders to exclude slave hunters from their camps. But he told Browning, as early as July 1861, that the government neither should nor would send back to bondage such as came to our armies. What to do with these fugitives was a puzzle. They shouldn't be returned to their masters. They couldn't live in idleness near Union army camps, and they mustn't be turned loose on the Negro-phobic border states. The northern states did not want them. In his search for a solution, Lincoln turned back, as he so often did in a crisis, to the ideas of Henry Clay, and he proposed in his annual message to colonize these runaway slaves at some place or places in a climate congenial to them. The idea wasn't a new one for Lincoln. He'd endorsed colonization as early as 1852 in his eulogy on Clay, and subsequently made speeches before meetings of the Illinois Colonization Society. During the debates with Douglas, he more than once mentioned colonization, though he admitted it was an impractical solution of the race problem. More recently, the Blair family, who for years had made colonization something of a hobby, had revived his interest in the subject. Frank Blair, as a representative from Missouri, had long favored emigration of the sable race bred in the pestilence of Africa to Central America. With the outbreak of the war, his father, Francis Preston Blair Sr., alerted Lincoln that the time had come when the deportation or extermination of the African race from among us was inevitable. Montgomery Blair joined his father and brother in recommending colonization of freedmen as absolutely indispensable to prevent unspeakable horrors, because blacks and whites could never live together in peace. By the 1860s, most colonizationists who'd earlier favored sending freedmen to Africa endorsed setting up a colony of blacks under the protection of the United States somewhere in Central America, or the Caribbean, Haiti, the Danish West Indies, Dutch Guiana, and British Honduras were among the sites considered possible. But a tract of land in New Granada, later Panama, on the Chiriqui Lagoon, was the favorite of many. Here, Ambrose W. Thompson, a Philadelphian who'd made a fortune in shipbuilding, had acquired a claim to several hundred thousand acres of land located at what was likely to be the terminus of a projected railroad across the isthmus. The lagoon was supposed to be deep enough to serve as an American naval base. The land was especially suited for growing cotton, and it allegedly contained rich stores of coal, which Thompson promised to sell to the Navy at half the usual price. It would, the Blairs urged, be the ideal location for a colony of American freedmen. Lincoln thought the idea was worth looking into. He appointed Ninian W. Edwards, his wife's brother-in-law, to review the prospectus and other legal documents submitted by the Cherokee Improvement Company, and learned that the claims of Thompson and the other entrepreneurs were fully verified. Because the project would involve the Navy, he asked Secretary Wells's opinion, but that resolute New Englander, opposed to colonization in principle, refused to have anything to do with the scheme. Because money would be needed for the project, the president also asked for Chase's advice. Responding more tactfully than Wells, the Secretary of the Treasury responded that he was generally much impressed by the prospects, but that he was too busy to give it his close attention. Lincoln then turned the project over to Secretary of the Interior Smith, who he knew was in favor of colonization, and gave it his conditional blessing. What began as a project for resettling runaway slaves escalated into a more ambitious plan for abolishing slavery in some, or perhaps all, of the border states, where it was a source of constant embarrassment to the Union government. Almost daily there was friction between local authorities sworn to uphold the state laws concerning slavery and military commanders reluctant to return fugitives to their masters. In addition, Lincoln knew that so long as these heavily populated and strategically located states maintained slavery, there was a possibility that they might join the Confederacy. He was also aware of the continued existence of slavery in the border states complicated foreign policy. So long as Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri remained slave states, European powers couldn't view the American conflict as one between freedom and slavery. Emancipation could thus strengthen the Union cause abroad, relieve friction between civil and military authorities in the Upper South, and weaken the Confederacy. During the winter of 1861-62, despite all the other issues he had to deal with, Lincoln worked with exceptional finesse to disarm the likely critics of his plan. Aware that opposition both to compensated emancipation and to colonization was strongest in New England, he took great pains to keep Sumner, the most conspicuous spokesman of abolitionism in the Congress, on his side. Patiently, he allowed Sumner to lecture him, sometimes two or three times a week, on his duty to act against slavery. In early December, the president and the senator had a long conversation about the problems facing the new session of Congress, and reviewed in great detail all issues relating to slavery. Sumner was delighted to discover that on all of them, we agreed, or agreed very nearly. As they parted, Lincoln said, "Well, Mr. Sumner, the only difference between you and me on this subject is a difference of a month or 6 weeks in time." "Mr. President," Sumner replied, "if that's the only difference between us, I'll not say another word to you about it till the longest time you name has passed by." A fortnight later, Lincoln further involved Sumner in his plans. Since November, the president had been working with George P. Fisher and Nathaniel B. Smithers to draft a bill for gradual emancipation in Delaware, where the number of slaves was inconsequential. Lincoln prepared two slightly different proposals, both of which promised federal funds to pay Delaware to emancipate its slaves. Under both plans, emancipation would begin immediately. One looked to total emancipation by 1867, the other by 1893. Lincoln preferred the second version, which would require the nation to pay the state $23,200 per year for 31 years. The president's proposals were printed and distributed to members of the Delaware legislature, but, as Fisher reported, due to perceived opposition, they were never introduced as bills. Though the Delaware emancipation scheme proved abortive, it was significant in that Sumner didn't oppose it. Representing an abolitionist constituency that for three decades had insisted on immediate, uncompensated emancipation, Sumner was persuaded to go along with Lincoln's plan. "Never should any question of money be allowed to interfere with human freedom," he concluded. With equal adroitness, Lincoln enlisted Chase's backing for his plan. Like the president, Chase was a colonizationist. During the debates on the Compromise of 1850, he declared unequivocally that the black and white races could not live together, except under the constraint of force, such as that of slavery, and he looked forward to the separation of the races, because the two were adapted to different latitudes and countries. At the same time, he was a staunch advocate of equal rights for Negroes, and of all the members of the cabinet, he was most clearly aligned with the anti-slavery element in the North. His voice, like Sumner's, would help still any clamor against gradual, compensated emancipation. Well aware of the secretary's vanity, Lincoln consulted him frequently when planning for emancipation, and he allowed Chase to draft a long, wordy message to Congress on the subject, which he quietly filed away unused. The president didn't turn to Chase simply as a matter of policy. The two men, complete strangers at the beginning of the administration, had developed an effective working relationship. Lincoln was impressed by the efficiency of Chase's Treasury Department and trusted the secretary's judgment on financial questions. As he told John Hay a little later, he generally delegated to Mr. Chase exclusive control of those matters falling within the purview of his department. In fact, the president knew a good deal about governmental finance and took an active role in helping Chase promote a National Banking Act. But he found it politic at times to claim total ignorance of such matters. "Money," he exclaimed to a group of New York financiers who wanted a change in banking legislation, "I don't know anything about money." For his part, Chase came to have a kind of grudging affection for the man who'd appointed him, and though he frequently differed with the president's policies and deplored his style of management, he kept reassuring himself in his diary that Lincoln was, after all, honest and well-meaning. To cement the loyalty of Chase and Sumner, Lincoln deliberately excluded Seward from all discussion of his emancipation project. The Secretary of State and Sumner were rivals for control of foreign relations, and Chase and Seward nearly always took opposing positions in the cabinet. The Trent Affair delayed Lincoln's introduction of his emancipation plan, and then Willie's death caused a further postponement, but by spring, he was finally ready with a short message on the abolishment of slavery, the first such proposal ever submitted to Congress by an American president. Early in the morning on March 6th, Sumner received an urgent summons to the White House. "I want to read you my message," Lincoln told him when he reached the White House. "I want to know how you like it. I'm going to send it in today." First, Lincoln read the manuscript aloud. Then Sumner went over it himself. He had some reservations about some of the language, especially the word abolishment, but concluded that Lincoln's style was so clearly aboriginal, autochthonous, that it would not bear verbal emendation. Delighted with its contents, Sumner could hardly bear to part with the manuscript, and he read it over and over again until Lincoln was obliged to say, "There now, you've read it enough, run away. I must send it in today." In the message, the president urged Congress to adopt a joint resolution declaring that the United States ought to cooperate with any state which may adopt gradual abolishment of slavery, giving to such state pecuniary aid to be used by such state in its discretion to compensate for the inconveniences, public and private, produced by such change of system. Such a declaration, he held, was strictly constitutional because it made no claim of federal authority to interfere with slavery within state limits, but allowed each state perfectly free choice to accept or reject the proposed offer. He argued for his resolution not on the basis of morality or justice, but on the ground that it would remove any temptation for the border states to join the proposed Confederacy. To congressmen from these states, he added the warning that as the war continued, it would be impossible to foresee all the incidents which may attend and all the ruin which may follow it. Lincoln's careful preparation led to an overwhelmingly positive reception of his proposal. How could anybody object to a proposal endorsed by the Blairs, by Sumner, and by Chase? The San Francisco Daily Alta California pretty well summarized press opinion by calling the message just the right thing at the right time and in the right place. In New York, the Evening Bulletin, the Herald, the World, and the Evening Post all endorsed Lincoln's plan. This message constitutes of itself an epoch in the history of our country, rejoiced the New York Tribune, often so critical of Lincoln. It's the day star of a new national dawn. The next day, the Tribune added, "We thank God that Abraham Lincoln is President of the United States, and the whole country, we cannot doubt, will be thankful that we have at such a time so wise a ruler." Lincoln followed press reactions to his proposal closely. When the New York Times, usually a faithful supporter of his administration, complained in an early edition about the cost of compensated emancipation, the president promptly straightened out the editor, Henry J. Raymond. Less than one half of a day's cost of the war would pay for emancipating all the slaves in Delaware, he pointed out, and the cost of 87 days of conflict would free the slaves in all the border states, plus the District of Columbia. Raymond, who'd been out of the office, had already corrected his newspaper's slant and published several articles commending the message as a masterpiece of practical wisdom and sound policy. But border state congressmen said nothing. Lincoln sent for Montgomery Blair, who'd made brave promises about the extent of emancipation sentiment in the Upper South. Blair suggested that the congressmen were waiting for the army to win a victory. "That is just the reason why I do not wish to wait," Lincoln told him impatiently. "If we do have success, they may feel it matters not whether we do anything about the matter." The next day, Blair brought the border state representatives to receive the same message. Disclaiming any intent to injure the interests or wound the sensibilities of the slave states, Lincoln reminded them that failure to solve the problem of slaves who fled to Union lines strengthened the hopes of the Confederates that at some day the border states would unite with them, and thus prolonged the war, stressing that his plan was voluntary and that it recognized that emancipation was a subject exclusively under the control of the states. He urged them to give it serious consideration. The congressman haggled with him. Was his plan constitutional? Would Congress appropriate the money needed to put it in effect? Was this a first step toward general emancipation? Would emancipation be followed by colonization of the freedmen? Lincoln tried to assuage their fears, but salvaged nothing from the meeting except John J. Crittenden's assurance that all the congressmen believed the president was solely moved by high patriotism and sincere devotion to the happiness and glory of his country. Congressional debates on Lincoln's resolution were brief. Several representatives from the border states thought it was unconstitutional. At the other extreme, John Hickman, an abolitionist representative from Pennsylvania, sneered that the message was an attempt on the part of the president to compensate for his failure to meet the just expectation of the party which elected him to the office he holds. A few abolitionists outside of Congress saw in Lincoln's plan a design to save slavery. "Every concession made by the president to the enemies of slavery has only one aim," growled Gurovsky. It's to mollify their urgent demands by throwing them small crumbs, as one tries to mollify a boisterous and hungry dog. But such dissents were few, and Congress adopted the resolution by overwhelming majorities. Then, disappointingly, nothing happened. Because none of the border states agreed to accept the plan Congress had endorsed in general terms, there was no need for any further legislation. The only concrete result of the entire effort was a bill for compensated emancipation in the District of Columbia. It met some of Lincoln's specifications as a blueprint for freedom, in that it provided for paying up to $300 to masters for every slave emancipated, and appropriated $100,000 for colonizing such of the slaves as desired to emigrate. But this wasn't the measure Lincoln really wanted. Emancipation imposed on the federal district was very different from abolition voluntarily adopted by the border slave states. If some one or more of the border states would move fast, I should greatly prefer it, he explained to Horace Greeley. But none did so, and he signed the District of Columbia bill on April 16th.
This ends Disc 19.